Hey folks, you're a very good developer. Probably. Regardless, you do write bugs. That's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. You can see the severity and the scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, it's a name so common that they have to include the top-level domain in their advertising to make sure you remember it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Open source, full stack, web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts. If you can program it, they can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Your code may be broken. Let's fix it together. Visit Sentry.io. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking to Fabien Sanclard, who has written a wonderful book called The Game Engine Black Book for Doom. And I'm sitting here with this book in front of me, filled with highlights. I've been reading this book and highlighting so many pages, and I'm so excited to chat with you today, sir.
Oh, hello, Scott. Thank you for having me.
This is such an interesting idea. You've written both Game Engine Black Book for Doom, and then previously you wrote one for Wolfenstein 3D. And my wife saw me reading this yesterday, and she said, "Are you studying?" Because she saw diagrams and photographs and full color and code, and she thought I was studying for some kind of a test. And I was telling her what a joy it was to explore the last 25 years of Doom.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you enjoyed it. That's part of why I wrote it. Part of it was nostalgia and allow people to live again that era.
Mm-hmm. So this is Doom is 25 years old this year, is it?
Yeah. On December 10th of this year, it turned 25 years old. It was released on December 10th, 1993.
And you have written an over 400-page full-color book as, if I may, a love letter to Doom, to Carmack, to everyone that worked on this project. It's extraordinary. This must have taken a very long time.
No, actually, this one went pretty fast. I wrote it pretty much in 6 months. Then I left it untouched for a while so I could proofread it with new eyes, and it was a pretty fast pace. It's a love letter, but it's also a thank you letter for all I've learned, all I've been able to do with this source code, and all what this game has brought to my life.
That's amazing that you're saying that it was a pretty quick write, because I don't want people to think, oh, he wrote this book in 6 months and it must, you know, or a year. There's so much detail. Why was it easy to write? Was it just because it flowed out of you?
One of the reasons is that, first of all, I had all the tools ready. Before that, I wrote a book about Wolfenstein 3D. This one was hell. I gave up three times over the course of 3 years trying to make it happen. It was very difficult. This one, it was like a really well set up framework. And all of the content, pretty much I had it in my head, because I've been writing about Doom. Mm-hmm. Some of the techniques used in the game, like binary space partition, texture mapping, and all those things. So it wasn't really, really hard, and especially because it also followed the same structure as the first book, which is first I describe the environment, the hardware, and then I describe the team and the tools they built, and finally I dive into the code and the engine. So that was pretty easy in comparison to the previous one.
Mm-hmm. And you'd put together your own production pipeline, because this is a self-published book that you wrote in LaTeX?
Yeah, everything was right hand by hand with LaTeX, Sublime Text Editor, and Inkscape for the drawings.
That's fantastic. One of the things that I was a little surprised about when I had my expectations when I bought it was that there would be I would be reading code within the first page. But interestingly, there's almost 100 pages of context. This isn't a book about code. It's a book about history, about teams, about schedules.
Yes, it's very important. So that's something that was even more vivid when I wanted to talk about Wolfenstein, is that even though you had the source code, if you don't know about what was the hardware or what was the constraint of the time, it means almost nothing. So that's why I spend a lot of time describing everything. So without being too technical, for example, the 486 was a new CPU at the time that was using a cache line technology to make things faster. And if you're not aware of that, when you ring the Doom source code anyway, things are organized the way they are. You don't really understand why it's done this way.
That's so important to point out, because people who may not have been around or been aware of this in 1989 to 1992, there was a lot of happening with floating point processors and the SX versus the DX46. The decisions that the Doom team would have needed to make, they could have found themselves without a processor to run their app, or they would have made they would have targeted the wrong instruction set and put themselves in a bad situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that. And it's even more important nowadays, where I feel like developers are more and more remote from the hardware. Like typically, if you write something in JavaScript, on Chrome, you're running inside a VM, which is a process on top of an operating system. And even that is sometimes virtualized somehow. And we're so far remote that we don't really factor in the limitation. Sometimes we program and assume we have limitless resources like infinite CPU power or infinite RAM. Whereas when you program in this era for Doom and Wolfenstein, you had to have specific budget in terms of RAM, in terms of CPU cycle you were willing to spend on different part of the rendering pipeline.
Yeah, it's that working within constraints. It's a very different type of programming, thinking about memory, but not just that, thinking about how many processor instructions, thinking about ticks. They had a series of constraints that they decided upon. They said, this has to work in 4 megs of RAM. You know, they had minimum specs. One of the things I thought was interesting was you said that there was a controversial decision about the number of ticks that they could work within that allowed them to achieve some things, but also cause them problems later. What was that controversial decision?
Oh, so they hard-coded the frame rate at 35 hertz. So later on, it led to a problem that even if your machine can render 70 frames per second, because the world only updates at 35 hertz, you only see 35 movement per second. So that solved a lot of the issues, because you could play the game on any computer and have the same world ticks. But later on, when Pentium came out, which were a much faster machine, they could not really run at the full potential because they were limited.
So the idea that you would somehow get a faster machine and get 4 times more frame rate, or you know, 4 times more something, it didn't scale in the way that we think of modern game engine scaling, in the sense of scaling up, but it did scale down extraordinarily.
It did scale down, and it did scale up at some, to a certain extent, because even when they released the game, no machine could run at 35 hertz. So most machines were running at 20. So later on, Pentium were about to reach 35, which was still very pleasant visually. But even nowadays, when you look at a model in games, you can have games running at 1,000 frames per second. But even the monitor, the display, is going to run at 60, or if you're lucky, 120. So you still have a limiting factor.
That's right. That's right. One of the things I also thought was interesting is, and I love that you actually found Usenet posts from 1994 with people, and you included their actual emails, arguing about whether or not Doom ran faster with a floating point coprocessor on a 486 DX or an SX. And there was a lot, even then on the internet, there was a lot of fake news. No one could decide whether it was better with this processor or better with that one.
Yeah. I wouldn't maybe call it fake news, because it was not intentional.
Of course.
But it's so representative of the era and how hard it was to access the information. John Carmack mentions it later on in the book, When he was doing computer graphics research, he had very little access to resources. And everything was limited back in the days. We are almost the same age, and maybe you try to program back mm-hmm. in the 90s. A compiler was $1,000. It was something really hard to access. So information, even the tooling, was hard to access.
The idea that tooling was hard to access, it looks, when you look at the historical context here, it almost makes me wonder how we got anything done. You actually include a table of prices, and you are kind enough to show us what it would cost to buy computers now. Some of the workstations that they were using would be $12,000 or $15,000 today, but I can't imagine someone tolerating that kind of to buy a computer today.
Well, you know, I'm pretty sure in 20 years, people are going to say the same thing about now. And it's true for all time periods. Some people would say we're crazy to buy phones that are $1,000, yet we still do.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. They were targeting ultimately to start the PC, which was a business machine. So they had the challenge of graphics cards and a machine that was used to pushing text around to start pushing graphics around. But they didn't develop on the PC, right?
No, they did not develop on the PC. That was one of the big decisions they made at id Software. They actually developed everything on Next workstation, which was manufactured by Next, a company created by Steve Jobs in 1989.
And this was a real workstation. This was a revolutionary computer. This is one of the computers that a lot of historians feel like it should have succeeded and taken over the world, but It didn't, even though it's you can find its influence in code even on the iPhone today.
Well, yes, I actually disagree. I think it failed, and rightfully so, because it was.
Really?
I think it was overpriced. The operating system was gorgeous. So many innovation. It worked very well, and it still works because it's at the heart of macOS mm-hmm. now. But I think. Maybe Steve Jobs in his quest for perfection, I think he probably took it too far.
Yeah. And $12,000 in 1991 was a non-trivial amount of money for a Next Cube.
Especially when you should consider it could only render four colors. Actually, it could only render black, white, and two shades of gray.
But it was so high resolution.
It was very high resolution, but I don't know. I think it's very interesting, the choice they made. So to write this book, I actually acquired the Next color station.
Really?
I wanted to experience the real pipeline, how long it took to compile, how it was to code on this machine. And what surprised me is that it's not actually able to run Doom properly. If you start... if you start Doom on the Next station, it's going to run at 10 frames per second. Mm-hmm. So really, what they got out of the Next station was the stability of the text editor, the power of Objective-C, because developing the tools was much faster. But it was, at first sight, it's not obvious that it's going to be a machine done to develop first-person shooter.
I was impressed that you include some screenshots that are like you must have taken them yourself that show the what it would have looked like to develop it on DOS at 80 by 25 or 80 by 50, and then you put it next to what it looks like on Next. It's almost as if they picked the Next simply because they wanted to see more lines of code on the screen, which I know is an oversimplification.
To some extent, it's true. The main reason John Carmack mentioned is that he didn't crash all the time.
That's it.
Reportedly, he would lose all his work several times a day.
Oh,
and back in the day, editor did not save automatically. So imagine yourself working on an algorithm for an hour mm-hmm. and losing it all. I can see why they were motivated to change.
Today's sponsor is Tiny Technologies. If you're a developer who needs to build beautiful writing experiences for your end users, then check out Tiny. You may recognize the name. TinyMCE is the rich text editing platform that helped launch and scale startups like Medium and WordPress and Atlassian, and it's used by thousands of businesses like IBM, Adobe, Intel, the NASDAQ, Visa, and the list goes on. They enable 10,000 active applications and host 1 million users on the Tiny Cloud. They also recently launched a cloud asset management system called TinyDrive. and they will soon release a re-architected UI called TinyMCE 5 to meet the needs of today's content creators. So go check out tiny.cloud/Hanselman for a free 30-day trial of their premium offerings. That's tiny.cloud/Hanselman. So you describe in great detail the pipeline here. It's interesting that they are building on a Motorola, but they're targeting an Intel. So they even the endianness is different between the two processors.
Yeah, everything was different. On DOS, you had access to the hardware. On Next, you had to use whatever frameworks they were using. You cannot access the screen directly. Same thing for the keyboard. The timer is not the same. Everything is different. That worked to the Doom's advantage in a long time because there is the way Doom is structured is that there is a core and you have subsystems which are very cleanly layered. There are no layer violations. So to get out or to get in, you have to go through those subsystems. Everything is very clearly defined. And that's why Doom was so easy to port later on to other platform, because the only work you have to do is to rewrite those tiny subsystem and all the remaining core remain unaffected.
So it was very much an example of a single responsibility principle.
Yeah.
It's interesting that on the first preface where you get there in John Carmack, his first sentence is that Doom was almost or effectively the perfect game. And I thought to myself, wow, that's a little bit egotistical. But then you read the book and you go, well, it kind of was. A perfect schedule, perfect storm. Just the whole team came together to make something that, you know, while it shipped with a bug or two, has held up 25 years later as really just the perfect game.
I agree with that. I don't think it's showing off. Mm-hmm. Evangeline Romero wrote in his interview that the game turned out exactly the way you wanted. And the game felt very solid, very fast. The engine was, close to perfection, I would say. To me, it's the best game they ever produced.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if people today, if my kids, if people who are in their 20s or people who are younger than Doom is, what they will experience that will cause them to have that kind of, that visceral feeling in their chest, like, oh my goodness. Like when I saw Wolfenstein, you could have knocked me over with a feather. And then Doom, the walls were not just square. I mean, it was so unbelievable. We hadn't seen anything like it. What is the next thing for that? When in 2020 or 2025, that's going to knock over my son or my daughter with a feather?
I'm not sure it's going to be based on technology. I think the a lot of good games, the design is much more important now. I think we are reaching a point where the graphic is not really improving anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe it will come to VR. Personally, I have a hard time with VR because I get motion sickness.
Yeah.
It's really hard to tell where it's going to go. What's remarkable, though, is that Doom is still enjoyable nowadays. The technology is obsolete, but the gameplay is still there. It's still a face-based game with a lot of secret. And that's the genius of the designer of the game.
And you spent some time talking about how they designed the levels, how much work was put into it. And if you look at the amount of work spent on Doom.exe versus the WAD files, where's all the data files, it really is kind of, is it the first example of an engine with that you could then create unlimited content with?
No, with Wolfenstein, it was already an engine. Mm-hmm. It was just much harder to access. I don't think they were as open as they were with Wolf. When they saw what Than made with Wolfenstein, they intentionally created an archive format which would be easy to modify. And even in Tom Hall's pre-release, they promised an open game where they would publish the specs of the asset format.
And they published the source code just a few years later, 4 years after it came out. This is so innovative. These are the kinds of things people do now in the 2010s, the 2015s. To be doing that 25 years ago, to be that progressive and thoughtful with your code, with your assets, and with your data format is extraordinary.
That was extraordinary, and to me, that's the true spirit of people who love programming. You share what you know, and you just don't keep it. You don't keep it for yourself. Mm-hmm. there is John Carmack in his early days when he was writing plans, he was often quoting the right thing to do, which come from a book, Hackers. And releasing the source code to all the people who loved it was really the right thing to do.
Yeah. Somewhere in the middle of the book, when we start talking about the 3D renderer, you make the kind of comment that they had a contract to, while they were in the middle of making Doom, they're going to go and port Wolfenstein to Super Nintendo, which is a very, very small, underpowered machine. And they kind of forgot about it. And then they went, oh, crap, the deadline is soon. We need to do that. So they stop working on Doom. They run over, start working on the SNES, and realize that their original algorithms are not going to cut it. And you had made the comment about how now we just, you know, we go on Google or Stack Overflow. Back then, you have to order research papers and have them delivered and get copies of papers to figure out if there's a solution to your technical problem.
Yeah. And in this occurrence, actually, it's not even in a book. I think he found a solution. It was on a VHS, a recording of some computer graphics convention or something like that.
Oh, wow. So he was watching Bruce Naylor's talk at some conference and then ordered his Bell Labs paper and learned about BSPs. Maybe you could speak a little bit about what a BSP is and why it's so significant.
So BSP stands for Binary Space Partition, and it's a very efficient way to sort the world. So once you pre-process the world and you're going to repeatedly slice it in half until everything is convex, meaning that from any point, you can see every other point in this area. Mm-hmm. And once you have that, it's very easy to render back to front or front to back. And that was the key of the entire engine.
So everything is convex. So nothing is open-ended. Everything folds in on itself as opposed to opens out. And then you chop everything up in the level. You actually have wonderful graphics where you show the progression from the level editor until the convex leafs to show the creation of the first episode and the first map and why that's so important. I was actually able to explain it to my non-technical spouse, who is not a programmer, and they had no trouble understanding why that was an important optimization.
Well, that's the goal of the book. When I first got into computer graphics, I had a very hard time to understand BSPs and Oak trees and all those complicated barbaric technique. I think to some extent, I wrote the book I wish I could have just purchased.
It's interesting that this is so important. It really comes down to that constraint that we talked about at the beginning. It takes 11 minutes to go and process all of this ahead of time for the 30 maps of Doom. So they're basically, you know, they're pre-chewing their food so that the end user's computer doesn't have to do all of that chewing itself.
Yeah, so this pre-processing was quite annoying for designers because with Wolfenstein, they would just draw the map and instantly jump into the game to see how it worked. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they had a delay between the time they finished the map and they could actually test it. So, and that became even worse with Quake. They kept on adding more and more pre-processing, but that was the only way, seemingly, to make it work.
Mm-hmm. They also were very innovative in their use of subpixels. Had that been used before this time?
I'm not sure it had been used. According to John Carmack, it was not widely used, if any.
One of the things that John Carmack says that I thought was so funny was that because he was effectively disconnected, right? The internet was FidoNet and CompuServe and email between universities at the time. You couldn't just go and Google something. That he would find himself all alone working in a vacuum. He would create something like, you know, LZW compression, and then discover that, oh, well, that was also created by this person and this person and this person.
Yeah, and I think that illustrates how silly patents are. Mm. You can rediscover something independently without actually stealing it from somebody.
Yeah, the first example, of course, being the light bulb, where it's the person that got there first who gets all of the glory, and the other one is forgotten to history.
Yeah, sadly.
Yeah. I also appreciated that that this book was very inclusive in that it didn't force me to think about math. I didn't really get into equations until about 200 pages in, and even then they were somewhat straightforward to understand. I was worried there was going to be a lot of math.
Yeah, so that's because my brain is allergic to mathematics. I wish it wasn't. I try to build up the strengths. Mm-hmm. Education in France is very strongly focused on mathematics, and it was a difficult time for me. And I try to explain things with drawings, because as soon as I see a mathematic formula, I try to step back. And I wish it wasn't that way, but I believe there are many people like me. So maybe that's why they like the book.
Well, I'm one of them, and I appreciate that as well. So do you think that this is an important book for young people to read, for people who are, you know, who just pick up Unreal and then make a game, you know, and don't think about the shoulders of the giants that they're standing on?
I think if people just want to make a game, they better off using their time, deepening their knowledge of Unreal. Mm-hmm. There are three reasons why this book exists. The main reason is that one, I wanted to preserve history. Mm. I wanted people to be able to go to Doom source code and understand everything with the context. The second is that I wanted to make sure I understood the book, the Doom code very well. And the best way to make sure you understand something well is to try to explain it to somebody. Mm-hmm. And the third selfish reason was that I wanted to write a book. For people who are in the game industry, as I mentioned earlier, what they can get from this book is the spirit it takes to achieve greatness. And it's not a secret. It's just a lot of hard work, and be hopeful and believing in yourself.
Mm-hmm. One of the two of the fun things that I liked particularly about the book was that as I get towards the end, and I'm wondering where you're going with this, and we get into the great graphics and you talk about high and low detail mode, then you spent a really non-trivial amount of time talking about the ports. Once the PC version succeeds, they spend basically 3 years porting it to six major systems, from the Jaguar to the Super Nintendo. And like you point out, Doom runs on watches. It runs anywhere. Like it's almost the first thing you port when you make a new machine.
Yeah, so originally I was not going to talk about the console port. And then I started to look into it, and every single port has a very interesting story. Mm. The Jaguar is fairly was done by John Carmack and Dave Taylor. So it's interesting to see how they work together. Mm-hmm. But then later on, you can see the 3DO port, which was a complete failure, to see all the backstory that went into it, or the PlayStation port, which nearly was a disaster, and they managed to turn it around and make it the best port ever. The history of each port was so rich, and the hardware was so interesting that I thought it had to be in the book.
Yeah, I mean, just as I've learned how they go and render this 2.5, you know, not quite 3D, but 2.5D world, I'm starting to understand how everything is thought about. And then suddenly we're talking about triangles and doing things a totally different way, because they rewrote the engine for different systems, because that's how the game, the hardware makers insisted that they do it on different systems.
Yeah, to me, the most fascinating port is probably the Jaguar. Mm-hmm. It's without being too technical, you have two different CPUs, and they have different architecture. That means if you build Doom, you compile it for the Motorola CPU, the 68000, and then you want to use the other CPU, you need to use another instruction set. So essentially, they compiled a part of the game for one CPU, part of the game for another CPU, and they were loading the instruction at runtime, and they were streaming it. They broke down the rendition, the rendering engine, in seven parts, and then they were streaming it as the frame was being rendered. To me, that's mind-blowing what they managed to achieve.
Yeah, the Jaguar in 1993 was, 64-bit in a commercial system was just unheard of at this point.
Yeah, to me, it felt like it was a bit of fake news at that time, because 64-bit system were unheard of at the time, and I think they played on the world a little bit when because the bus was 64, the GPU was 64, but the rest of it was 16 and sometimes 8.
Yep.
So maybe that's why they broke the bit war, because people may finally realize how silly it was.
Mm-hmm. I really do encourage people to check the book out and pick this up. It is one of those books, like you say, in the book, in fact, that you wanted it to be a kind of book that would be meaty, that you could hold in one hand and have some tea in your other hand and just sit there and explore. I love that you spent almost 100 pages in just appendix. I got to the end and I said, oh, I'm not even at the end. There's appendices, there's dot plans, there's the original press releases, there's interviews. I mean, even the appendices are almost a book in themselves.
Yeah, again, it was to give people more context. Mm-hmm. The press release. So Tom Hall wrote this press release in January 1993 when they had nothing. Mm-hmm. They promised texture mapping, they promised diminished lighting, they promised a bunch of stuff that they hadn't done. And amazingly, they delivered most of them. Interviews are also very interesting. And yeah, it just gives a lot of context. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm very detail-oriented, and that's why I wrote 400 pages about Doom. But I every time somebody explains something to me, mm-hmm. I always find myself asking questions about why is it done this way? And it's always a matter of context.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show and giving us even more context.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Fantastic. I'm going to include links to all of this in the show notes, and I really encourage you that check out the Game Engine Black Book. You can find links to Amazon and Google Books up on Fabien's website. You can find it at Amazon or your local bookstore. It is a joy, and I would really encourage you to check out the physical version of the book. It might cost more than the PDF, but it's just a gorgeous, you know, every page has got some color or some screenshot or some photograph. It's a wonderful piece of history. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.